The other thing that struck me when I was reading the book is how much of what goes on in New York City impacts the state, and particularly the politics of the state. And I'm thinking now in terms of labor legislation, it gets passed because of the inordinate power of municipal unions, of urban unions. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that and the origins of the Taylor Law in particular.
Yeah. That's an interesting story, which I did some for the book. I don't think I really did, a thorough job, frankly. I think someone else is going to have to come along, and bits and pieces have been told. But, it is interesting that one of the arguments, I'm going to get to your question, I'm going to take a loop to get to it, is that, there were a lot of hopes and expectations that came out of the 1930s and the New Deal. And in the 40s, it became clear that some of them weren't going to be realized through the federal government. And one thing that happened in New York State, not just New York City, was that the unions sort of took upon themselves to pursue some of these goals, some through collective bargaining and some through state legislation. So, for example, disability insurance. New York State was one of the first states to get disability insurance, which we kind of take for granted now. But, that was a very, very important thing. The biggest problem of sickness and disease for workers was not paying medical bills, but what do you do about the loss of income, So the fact that you had a strong labor movement in New York City helped build the base for some progressive labor legislation statewide. And I think you see examples of that, like the disability law, like the state minimum wage, which we had here from fairly early on, and a number of other things. There are also examples where it sort of works the other way. Upstate politics affects New York. And the history of how public employees are treated in some ways is an upstate story. Right after World War II, there were a lot of public employee strikes upstate. There was a general strike in Rochester. There were teachers' strikes in Buffalo. And as a result of those strikes, New York State passed a very strong law forbidding strikes by public employees. It was called the Condon-Wadlin Act. It was named after two state legislators. And basically the bill said, if you go on strike, you're fired, period. And yes, you could be rehired, but if you're rehired, you'd be probationary for, I think it was 3 years or 5 years. And you couldn't get the benefit of any increase in wages that came from the strike. So even if you strike won and they, a higher wage scale, and they fired you and they rehired you, you couldn't get the higher wages. So it was very draconian law. And the problem with the law from this, in a sense, enforcement point of view, is it was so strong that as public employee unionism began to grow, particularly as it began to grow not just upstate but then downstate, workers started going on to strike and the state really couldn't enforce the law. And the real test of this came in 1966 when the New York City transit workers went on strike. And they went on strike for almost 2 weeks. It paralyzed the city. It was this tremendous drama. The strike began on January 1st, the contracts. Everyone went after their New Year's Eve parties, in the middle of the winter. And they sort of stumbled out at 3 in the morning, and the trains and buses weren't working. And for 12 days, New York was shut, and the workers won a big contract. The question is, what are you going to do about this law? Because we're going to fire all the, it was just impractical. So this was when Nelson Rockefeller was the governor, and he cut a deal with the union leadership and the state legislature, which essentially gave amnesty to the workers, which really effectively killed the old law. Because, if in such a flamboyant manner unions could defy it, it was a kind of useless law. By the way, I think part of that deal was that the union, the New York Transit Union, did not support the Democrat in the next gubernatorial election, which I suspect was never on a piece of paper, but was part of the arrangement. Rockefeller then went to the state legislature and said, we need to do something. And he appointed a commission headed by a very well-known labor mediator named George Taylor, to study the problem, and they came back and proposed a new law, which, with some modification by the legislature, became what we call to this day the Taylor Law. And that law did a couple of things. It continued the prohibition against strikes, but it had much more gradated penalties, so that although there were serious penalties and seriously discouraged strikes, you didn't fire the whole workforce. Generally speaking, the maximum penalty has been 2 days' loss of pay for every day you go on strike, and then the unions, in addition to the individuals, can suffer some penalties. Many New York City municipal unions were bitterly opposed to this law for precisely those penalties for the continuation on the ban of strikes, which they felt was inappropriate. But there's another side of the Taylor Law, which people in New York City often forget, which is that for the first time, it really said that public employees in New York State have the right to join a union, and that a local employer, public employer, a school district or whatever, can't simply say, no, we don't want to do this. They have to, if petitioned, hold an election, you know, or determine the desires of the workforce. And if a majority of the workforce wants to have a union, then they have a right to join a union, and that municipality or school district or wherever it is legally obligated to engage in collective bargaining. And for areas of the state that had not been unionized, which includes most of the state government and many of the upstate school districts and local governments, this gave a legal procedure for workers who wanted to join a union to do so for the first time. And they went in by literally the hundreds of thousands. I think this is one of the biggest expansions of the national labor movement since the CIO was created. Now, in New York City, they don't even know what you're talking about when you're talking about this. They just think of the Taylor Law as, you know, oh, that's this law that keeps us from striking. So it's a kind of funny, complicated history. And to this day, when I talk about this issue in New York, and I mention the positive aspects of this to union audiences, people are giving these strange looks because they don't think of it so, you know, that way. But so this was really a kind of a Nelson Rockefeller kind of effort to come up with an orderly procedure to allow collective bargaining for public employees, but without the disruptions of strikes. And I think it's a, you know, law that's got many problems, but the fact that we still have it shows that it was certainly better than what it replaced.
Now, it would be a shame to let you go without having you talk a little bit about Mike Quill, since the 1966 strike, I suppose, killed, in quotes, yeah. Mike Quill. He died 2 days after the end of the strike. Right. How significant was he in the labor leadership of the city?
Well, Mike Quill is a really colorful character, and I ran into him when I wrote my book about the transit workers. He was the longtime leader of the New York, as well as the national, you know, transit union, and he was a Irish immigrant, came to New York in the 20s, and just a very colorful guy with an extremely quick wit and a very engaging personality. So he was an important figure in organizing the transit union, and for a while he was the head of the CIO Labor Council, and he was very left-wing for a while, very close to the Communist Party, which was somewhat unusual among Irish immigrants, and I think another very unusual thing about him, he was also a city councilman. He served 8 years in New York City Council, which is, you know, in the 19th century, it wasn't so unusual for labor leaders to also hold elected offices. But, you know, more recently, we don't see that very much. And he was one of the last major labor leaders in New York City to also be an elected official. So he had a very, very high profile. And I think his influence went beyond the numbers of the actual, you know, unionists he represented, which was never, you know, huge. I think the National Union was only 150,000. But, you know, it's funny, in America in the 50s or 60s, you know, you said, someone, who are the leading trade unionists? And they'd say sort of George, well, probably they'd say Jimmy Hoffa first, and then they'd say sort of George Meany, and then they'd say Walter Reuther. And Mike Quill might be the fourth or fifth person they would mention, because he was just this very sort of feisty fellow who really seemed to represent a kind of older spirit. You know, I saw a wonderful tape where he debated Congressman Hartley, of the Taft-Hartley Law, who was a big proponent of anti-labor legislation. They were once on one of these news shows, you know, debating each other. And you know, it was just a riot to see. He was a very colorful guy. In his actual negotiating practice in the 50s and 60s, he followed the trend towards kind of labor statesmanship. You know, he did try to, in spite of a lot of blustering rhetoric, avoid strikes, you know, kind of work out deals, mostly through the Democratic Party. What's interesting is he had some second thoughts. And very late in his life, in the 60s, he faced a lot of challenges. A lot of workers were unhappy with his leadership. There were black workers who felt the union's leadership did not reflect the changing makeup of the workforce. There were unionists who felt that Quill had not been militant enough, that public employees were falling behind private sector workers, you know, and they were unhappy with it. And Quill himself began to sort of question, you know, whether he had served labor well by sort of going this labor statesman route. So he went out with a sort of final blaze of glory in this strike. For years, he'd always threatened to have a transit strike and tie up New York. And, he said so many times, he's a little boy who cried wolf, you know. But in 1965, he really did it. And it was a very shocking thing in a lot of ways for many Americans. And it became a big national story, not just a New York story. And, of course, he was subject to the then-existing prohibition on strikes, and he was sent to jail. He told the judge that he could drop dead in his black robes as he was being carted off. He had a heart attack in jail. He was quite a sickly man by then, although most people hadn't realized it. The strike went on, and he was in the hospital during most of it and died shortly afterwards. And I think, you know, he was a very kind of dramatic example of a kind of reemergence of that, I think, of the kind of 1930s spirit in the 1960s. And in a way, he seemed like a very quirky fellow, although, you know, really, the next 5 or 6 years was a period of tremendous labor militancy, not just in New York, but in all the United States. People don't often focus on that period, but that was a period of tremendous strikes and militancies. And in a funny way, you could see Quill not just as a throwback, but also a little bit as a precursor to what was just about to come, this really the last great moment of labor advance in terms of contracts and status in American life came in that late 60s, early 70s period. So for a lot of reasons, I think Quill was great. And he was a very, I think, either loved or hated character in New York.
That period of advance in the late 60s, early 70s was also a period when America was immersed in the Vietnam War. What impact did the politics of Vietnam and even in the civil rights movement too very much, what impact did that have on the New York City labor movement?
Well, complicated, I think. I mean, one thing that people don't necessarily think of is that those movements, the protest movements of civil rights and anti-war, influenced labor. You know, and labor, which had once been a movement which, you know, did a lot of its work in the streets, you know, in demonstrations, you know, had increasingly turned to, you know, lobbying and the collective bargaining, returned to a kind of more militant mode of activity. You know, sometimes not very pretty, by the way, you know, boisterous and disruptive and sometimes violent in that period of time. And in some ways, I think they were reflecting a change in American culture that the civil rights and Vietnam anti-war movements fostered. Those movements also divide the labor movement, which was very split over both those issues. You know, over civil rights, everyone in New York was all gung-ho for it when it was in Birmingham, Alabama. The labor movement was a tremendous contributor to the Southern civil rights movement. But when you're talking about the civil rights movement in New York City itself, when you're talking about issues like jobs in public hospitals being built in New York City, should they just go to white unionized construction workers or should they go to Harlem residents? Desegregation of the building trades and other unions. That was an extremely controversial issue. When you got to the Vietnam War, the labor movement was very deeply divided. There were a number of unions that were among the early critics of the war, but there were many other unions that supported the war, and a lot of workers who, in a sense, didn't neatly fit into either category. They may have been very critical of the war, but also very critical of the anti-war movement, which they felt sort of mocked patriotic symbols. And I think they also resented college kids, many of whom were middle class and upper class. Those kids tended not to end up in the army, you know, and workers' kids fought that war, you know. And I think even if people didn't necessarily like the war, they also didn't like the way the critics of the war behaved. So this was a very divisive issue, and I think it did in many ways weaken the labor movement, or left it unprepared, maybe that's a better way to put it, for the crises that would come in the 70s. Because in the 70s, the national economy, but especially the New York City economy, went down the tubes, and this began a prolonged crisis for labor. And the New York labor movement dealt with that crisis in a very divided state of affairs.
Well, I hate to skip over that period of time, but we are running low on time. What I'd like to do is I'd like to finish off with one last question about sort of contemporary New York and the globalization movement and what's happening in New York, what's happening to New York workers, how are they responding to the globalization of the American economy?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question because in some ways New York is right now less affected by this. And it sounds a little counterintuitive because we think about garment being made overseas and things like that. But in terms of the internationalization of blue-collar work from New York, what's happened already is what's going to happen. Huge numbers of jobs have left, but the jobs that are still around are around for a reason. So in a funny way, this is not presenting the same kind of crisis to New York labor than maybe in other parts of the country. And of course, the labor movement is much less centered in manufacturing in New York than it was a generation ago. I certainly think, though, that the issues that are associated with globalization, the issues of the reemergence of sweatshops at home and abroad, the issues of international labor standards, the race to the bottom, which seems to be the new trend in the world economy, I think a lot of New York labor is alert to, including the leadership, which is a relatively young leadership, and I think is quite sympathetic to some of the student and activist kind of protests against them. It's not always easy to find, common ground as to how to make that alliance real. But I think if you compare it to the situation 15 or 20 years ago, where those different streams would have had a very difficult time talking to one another and cooperating, there's a much more shared sense of what the problems are and what directions people need to go with. I think there's also, of course, a tremendous puzzlement. You know, the forces at work seem so huge, the economic forces, the political forces, they seem so impenetrable. It's hard to get a handle on how you would assert control over some of these trends. So I think, just like every place else, workers in New York and people in New York are fairly puzzled. I think one thing that's particularly true in New York, and again, it's not unique, but globalization has also brought a tremendous mix of people into the city. And I think it's made it a very exciting place. New York has now got a bigger population than any time in its history. It's a result of new immigration. And I hope that that's going to increasingly reflect itself in the labor movement, which will bring, I think, a kind of sophistication to it in thinking about world issues. Because it's going to be a world movement, that might be very exciting. So we haven't quite gotten there yet, but it's not so inconceivable to me that we'll get there pretty soon.
Has 9/11 impacted labor in any significant way?
Well, it's impacted labor in some very horribly tragic ways. I mean, over 600 union members were killed on that day, and most of them in New York City. And, of course, for the fire and a few of the other groups, the hotel workers, these are tremendous losses, and it's hard to imagine how you recover from it. I think this kind of solidarity that we saw, particularly in the immediate aftermath, was quite extraordinary among workers, and a new appreciation of blue-collar labor, among non-working people as well as other working people, of not only the emergency rescue people, who obviously received a tremendous amount of attention, but also of construction workers who did all the initial demolition work and rescue work. Even groups like transit workers, there were 1,000 transit workers at Ground Zero in the first 2 days because they knew how to use heavy equipment. They were used to working around hazardous materials, and they all volunteered. They just showed up. And I think there's been a kind of appreciation that New York is not just a city of bond trenders and fashion designers and hip-hop artists that we didn't have a year ago, and I think we have now. Whether that'll translate into different social policies or political priorities, I'm not sure. But I think it does kind of validate once again how important labor is, to the life of the city.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Josh, for sitting down with us on Talking History and talking about your work. For those of you listening who want to learn more about New York City's workers, you can check out Josh's books, In Transit, The Transport Workers Union in New York City, 1933 to 1966, and more recently, Working Class New York, Life and Labor Since World War II. Thanks.
Thank you.